and solid basis. By reflecting on all possible methods of investigation available to his imagination, he concluded that the best among them is induction, which is the gathering of large numbers of facts and the detection of patterns. In order to obtain maximum objectivity, we must entertain only a minimum of preconceptions. Bacon proclaimed a pyramid of disciplines, with natural history forming the base, physics above and subsuming it, and metaphysics at the peak, explaining everything below, though perhaps in powers and forms beyond the grasp of man. He was not a gifted scientist, I cannot thread needles so well, or trained in mathematics, but a brilliant thinker who founded the philosophy of science. A Renaissance man, he took, in his own famous phrase, all knowledge to be his province. Then he stepped forward into the Enlightenment as the first taxonomist and master purveyor of the scientific method. He was Bucinator Novi Temporis, the trumpeter of new times who summoned men to make peace between themselves and turning with united forces against the nature of things, to storm and occupy her castles and strongholds and extend the bounds of human empire. Proud and reckless phrasing that, but appropriate to the age. Bacon, born in 1561, was the younger son of Sir Nicholas and Lady Anne Bacon, both of whom were well educated and extravagantly devoted to the arts. During his lifetime, England, ruled successively by Elizabeth I and James I, passed tumultuously from a feudal society to a nation-state and fledgling colonial power, with its own newly acquired religion and an increasingly powerful middle class. By the year of Bacon's death, 1626, Jamestown was an established colony with the first representative government in North America, and the Pilgrims were settled at Plymouth. Bacon saw the English language come to first full flower. He ranks as one of its grand masters, even though he regarded it as a crude parochial language and preferred to write in Latin. He lived in a golden age of industry and culture, surrounded by other global overachievers, including, most famously, Drake, Raleigh, and Shakespeare. Bacon enjoyed the privileges of rank through every step of his life. He was educated at Trinity College at Cambridge, which had been enriched some decades earlier by land grants from Henry VIII, and a century later was to serve as home to Newton. He was called to the bar in 1582, and 2 years afterward, appointed to membership in Parliament. Virtually from infancy, he was close to the throne. His father was Lord Keeper of the Seal, the highest judicial officer of the land. Elizabeth took early notice of the boy, talking with him often. Pleased by his precocious knowledge and gravity of manner, she fondly dubbed him the young Lord Keeper. He became a confirmed courtier for life, tying his political beliefs and fortunes to the crown. Under James I, he rose, through flattery and wise counsel, to the heights commensurate to his ambition, knighted in 1603, the year of James' accession. He was then named successively Attorney General, Lord Keeper, and in 1618, Lord Chancellor. With the last office, he was created first Baron of Verulam, and soon afterward, Viscount St. Alban. Then, having flown too close, too long to the royal flame, Bacon at last sustained near-fatal burns. He was targeted by a circle of determined personal enemies who found the wedge to his destruction in his tangled finances, and in 1621 successfully engineered his impeachment as Lord Chancellor. The charge to which he pleaded guilty was acceptance of bribes, gifts, he said, while in high public office. He was heavily fined, escorted through the Traitor's Gate, and imprisoned in the Tower of London. Unbowed, he at once wrote the Marquis of Buckingham, "Good, my lord, procure the warrant for my discharge this day. Howsoever, I acknowledge the sentence just, and for reformation's sake fit. I was the Justice Chancellor that hath been in the 5 changes since Sir Nicholas Bacon's time." He had been all that, and more. He was released in 3 days. Shorn at last of the burden of public ambition, he spent his last days totally immersed in contented scholarship. His death in the early spring of 1626 was symbolically condign, the result of an impromptu experiment to test one of his favorite ideas. As he was taking the air in a coach with Dr. Witherborne towards Highgate, John Aubrey reported at the time, "snow lay on the ground, and it came into my lord's thoughts why flesh might not be preserved in snow as in salt. They were resolved they would try the experiment presently. They alighted out of the coach and went into a poor woman's house at the bottom of Highgate Hill and bought a hen, and made the woman accentuate it, and then stuffed the body with snow, and my lord did help to do it himself. The snow so chilled him that he immediately fell so extremely ill that he could not return to his lodgings. He was taken instead to the Earl of Arundel's house close by. His condition remained grave, and he died on April 9th, most likely of pneumonia. The ache of disgrace had been subdued by the return to his true calling of visionary scholar. As he wrote in one of his oft-quoted adages, "He that dies in an earnest pursuit is like one that is wounded in hot blood, who for the time scarce feels the hurt." He saw his life as a contest between 2 great ambitions, and toward the end, he regretted having invested so much effort in public service with an equivalent loss of scholarship. "My soul," he mused, "hath been a stranger in life's pilgrimage." His genius, while of a different kind, matched that of Shakespeare. Some have believed, erroneously, that he was Shakespeare. He melded great literary gifts, so evident in the advancement of learning, with a passion for synthesis, 2 qualities most needed at the dawn of the Enlightenment. His great contribution to knowledge was that of learned futurist. He proposed a shift in scholarship away from rote learning and deductive reasoning from classical texts, and toward engagement with the world. "In science," he proclaimed, "is civilization's future." Bacon defined science broadly and differently from today's ordinary conception to include a foreshadowing of the social sciences and parts of the humanities. The repeated testing of knowledge by experiment, he insisted, is the cutting edge of learning. But to him, experiment meant not just controlled manipulations in the manner of modern science. It was all the ways humanity brings change into the world through information, agriculture, and industry. He thought the great branches of learning to be open-ended and constantly evolving. I do not promise you anything. But he nonetheless focused eloquently on his belief in the underlying unity of knowledge. He rejected the sharp divisions among the disciplines prevailing since Aristotle. And fortunately, he was reticent in this enterprise when needed. He refrained from forecasting how the great branches of learning would ultimately fall out. Bacon elaborated on, but did not invent, the method of induction as a counterpoint to classical and medieval deduction. Still, he deserves the title Father of Induction, on which much of his fame rested in later centuries. The procedure he favored was much more than mere factual generalizations, such as, to use a modern example, 90% of plant species have flowers that are yellow, red, or white, and are visited by insects. Rather, he said, start with such an unbiased description of phenomena, collect their common traits into an intermediate level of generality, then proceed to higher levels of generality, such as flowers have evolved colors and anatomy designed to attract certain kinds of insects, and these are the creatures that exclusively pollinate them. Bacon's reasoning was an improvement over the traditional methods of description and classification prevailing in the Renaissance, but it anticipated little of the methods of concept formation, competing hypotheses and theory that form the core of modern science. It was in psychology, and particularly the nature of creativity, that Bacon cast his vision farthest ahead. Although he did not use the word, it was not coined until 1653, he understood the critical importance of psychology in scientific research and all other forms of scholarship. He had a deep, intuitive feel for the mental processes of discovery. He understood the means by which the processes are best systematized and most persuasively transmitted. The human understanding, he wrote, is no dry light, but receives an infusion from the will and affections, whence proceed sciences which may be called sciences as one would. He did not mean by this to distort perception of the real world by interposing a prism of emotion. Reality is still to be embraced directly and reported without flinching. But it is also best delivered the same way it was discovered, retaining a comparable vividness and play of the emotions. Nature and her secrets must be as stimulating to the imagination as are poetry and fables. To that end, Bacon advised us to use aphorisms, illustrations, stories, fables, analogies, anything that conveys truth from the discoverer to his readers as clearly as a picture. The mind, he argued, is not like a wax tablet. On a tablet you cannot write the new till you rub out the old. On the mind, you cannot rub out the old except by writing in the new. Through light shed on the mental process, Bacon wished to reform reasoning across all the branches of learning. Beware, he said, of the idols of the mind, the fallacies into which undisciplined thinkers most easily fall. They are the real distorting prisms of human nature. Among them, idols of the tribe assume more order than exists in chaotic nature. Those of the imprisoning cave, the idiosyncrasies of individual belief and passion, of the marketplace, the power of mere words to induce belief in non-existent things, and of the theater, unquestioning acceptance of philosophical beliefs and misleading demonstrations. Stay clear of these idols, he urged. Observe the world around you as it truly is, and reflect on the best means of transmitting reality as you have experienced it. Put into it every fiber of your being. I do not wish, by ranking Francis Bacon so highly in this respect, to portray him as a thoroughly modern man. He was far from that. His younger friend, William Harvey, a physician and a real scientist who made a fundamental discovery, the circulation of the blood, noted dryly that Bacon wrote philosophy like a Lord Chancellor. His phrases make splendid marble inscriptions and commencement flourishes. The unity of knowledge he conceived was remote from the present-day concept of consilience, far from the deliberate systematic linkage of cause and effect across the disciplines. His stress lay instead upon the common means of inductive inquiry that might optimally serve all the branches of learning. He searched for the techniques that best convey the knowledge gained, and to that end he argued for the full employment of the humanities, including art and fiction, as the best means for developing and expressing science. Science, as he broadly defined it, should be poetry, and poetry, science. That, at least, has a pleasingly modern ring. Bacon envisioned a disciplined and unified learning as the key to improvement of the human condition. Much of the veritable library that accumulated beneath his pen still makes interesting reading. From his often quoted Essays and Maxims to Advancement of Learning, 1605, Novum Organum, The New Logic, 1620, and New Atlantis, 1627, the latter a utopian fable about a science-based society. Most of his philosophical and fictional writing was planned to implement the scheme of the unification of knowledge, which he called Instauratio Magna, literally, the Great Instauration, or the New Beginning. His philosophy raised the sights of a small but influential public. It helped to prime the scientific revolution that was to blossom spectacularly in the decades ahead. To this day, his vision remains the heart of the scientific technological ethic. He was a magnificent figure standing alone by necessity of circumstance, who achieved that affecting combination of humility and innocent arrogance present only in the greatest scholars. Beneath the title of Novum Organum, he had the publisher print these lines. Francis of Verulam reasoned thus with himself, and judged it to be for the interest of the present and future generations that they should be made acquainted with his thoughts. All histories that live in our hearts are peopled by archetypes in mythic narratives, and such, I believe, is part of Francis Bacon's appeal and why his fame endures. In the tableau of the Enlightenment, Bacon is the herald of adventure. "There is a new world waiting," he announced. "Let us begin the long and difficult march into its unmapped terrain." René Descartes, the founder of algebraic geometry and modern philosophy, and France's preeminent scholar of all time, is the mentor in the narrative. Like Bacon before him, he summoned scholars to the scientific enterprise, among whom was soon to follow the young Isaac Newton. Descartes showed how to do science with the aid of precise deduction, cutting to the quick of each phenomenon and skeletonizing it. "The world is three-dimensional," he explained, "so let our perception of it be framed in three coordinates. Cartesian coordinates, they are called today. With them, the length, breadth, and height of any object can be exactly specified and subjected to mathematical operations to explore its essential qualities." He accomplished this step in elementary form by reformulating algebraic notation so that it could be used to solve complex problems of geometry and further to explore realms of mathematics beyond the visual realm of three-dimensional space. Descartes' overarching vision was one of knowledge as a system of interconnected truths that can be ultimately abstracted into mathematics. "It all came to him," he said, "through a series of dreams on a November night in 1619, when somehow, in a flurry of symbols, thunderclaps, books, an evil spirit, a delicious melon, he perceived that the universe is both rational and united throughout by cause and effect. He believed that this conception could be applied from physics to medicine, hence biology, and even to moral reasoning. In this respect, he laid the groundwork for the belief in the unity of learning that was to influence Enlightenment thought profoundly in the 18th century. Descartes insisted upon systematic doubt as the first principle of learning. By his light, all knowledge was to be laid out and tested upon the iron frame of logic. He allowed himself only one undeniable premise, captured in the celebrated phrase, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. The system of Cartesian doubt, which still thrives in modern science, is one in which all assumptions possible are systematically eliminated so as to leave only one set of axioms upon which rational thought can be logically based and experiments can be rigorously designed. Descartes nonetheless made a fundamental concession to metaphysics. A lifelong Catholic, he believed in God as an absolutely perfect being, manifested by the power of the idea of such a being in his own mind. That given, he went on to argue for the complete separation of mind and matter. The stratagem freed him to put spirit aside to concentrate on matter as pure mechanism. In works published over the years 1637 to 1649, Descartes introduced reductionism, the study of the world as an assemblage of physical parts that can be broken apart and analyzed separately. Reductionism and analytic mathematical modeling were destined to become the most powerful intellectual instruments of modern science. The year 1642 was a signal one in the history of ideas, with Descartes' Meditationes de Prima Philosophia, just published, and Principia Philosophiae, soon to follow. Galileo died, and Newton was born. As Enlightenment history unfolded, Isaac Newton came to rank with Galileo as the most influential of the heroes who answered Bacon's call. A restless seeker of horizons, stunningly resourceful, he invented calculus before Gottfried Leibniz, whose notation was nevertheless clearer and is the one used today. Calculus proved to be, in company with analytic geometry, one of the two crucial mathematical techniques in physics and later in chemistry, biology, and economics. Newton was also an inventive experimentalist, one of the first to recognize that the general laws of science might be discovered by manipulating physical processes. While investigating prisms, he demonstrated the relation of the refrangibility of light to color, and from that, the compound nature of sunlight and the origin of rainbows. As in many great experiments of science, this one is simple. Anyone can quickly repeat it. With a prism, bend a beam of sunlight so that its different wavelengths fall out into the colors of the visible spectrum. Now bend the colors back together again to create the beam of sunlight. Newton applied his findings in the construction of the first reflecting telescope, a superior instrument perfected a century later by the British astronomer William Herschel. In 1684, Newton formulated the mass and distance laws of gravity, and in 1687, the three laws of motion. With these mathematical formulations, he achieved the first great breakthrough in modern science. He showed that the planetary orbits postulated by Copernicus and proved elliptical by Kepler can be predicted from the first principles of mechanics. His laws were exact and equally applicable to all inanimate matter, from the solar system down to grains of sand, and, of course, to the falling apple that had triggered his thinking on the subject 20 years previously. Apparently, a true story. The universe, he said, is not just orderly, but also intelligible. At least part of God's grand design could be written with a few lines on a piece of paper. His triumph enshrined Cartesian reductionism in the conduct of science. Because Newton established order where magic and chaos had reigned before, his impact on the Enlightenment was enormous. Alexander Pope celebrated him with a famous couplet. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, "Let Newton be," and all was light. Well, not all, not yet. But the laws of gravity and motion were a powerful beginning. And they started Enlightenment scholars thinking, why not a Newtonian solution to the affairs of men? The idea grew into one of the mainstays of the Enlightenment agenda. As late as 1835, Adolphe Quetelet was proposing social physics as the basis of the discipline soon to be named sociology. Auguste Comte, his contemporary, believed a true social science to be inevitable. Men, he said, echoing Condorcet, are not allowed to think freely about chemistry and biology, so why should they be allowed to think freely about political philosophy? People, after all, are just extremely complicated machines. Why shouldn't their behavior and social institutions conform to certain, still undefined, natural laws? Reductionism, given its unbroken string of successes during the next three centuries, may seem today the obvious best way to have constructed knowledge of the physical world, but it was not so easy to grasp at the dawn of science. Chinese scholars never achieved it. They possessed the same intellectual ability as Western scientists, as evidenced by the fact that, even though far more isolated, they acquired scientific information as rapidly as did the Arabs, who had all of Greek knowledge as a launching ramp. Between the 1st and 13th centuries, they led Europe by a wide margin. But according to Joseph Needham, the principal Western chronicler of Chinese scientific endeavors, their focus stayed on holistic properties and on the harmonious, hierarchical relationships of entities, from stars down to mountains and flowers and sand. In this worldview, the entities of nature are inseparable and perpetually changing, not discrete and constant, as perceived by the Enlightenment thinkers. As a result, the Chinese never hit upon the entry point of abstraction and break apart analytic research attained by European science in the 17th century. Why no Descartes or Newton under the heavenly mandate? The reasons were historical and religious. The Chinese had a distaste for abstract, codified law, stemming from their unhappy experience with the legalists, rigid quantifiers of the law, who ruled during the transition from feudalism to bureaucracy in the Qin Dynasty, 221 to 206 BC. Legalism was based on the belief that people are fundamentally antisocial and must be bent to laws that place the security of the state above their personal desires. Of probably even greater importance, Chinese scholars abandoned the idea of a supreme being with personal and creative properties. No rational author of nature existed in their universe. Consequently, the objects they meticulously described did not follow universal principles, but instead operated within particular rules followed by those entities in the cosmic order. In the absence of a compelling need for the notion of general laws, thoughts in the mind of God, so to speak, little or no search was made for them. Western science took the lead largely because it cultivated reductionism and physical law to expand the understanding of space and time beyond that attainable by the unaided senses. The advance, however, carried humanity's self-image ever further from its perception of the remainder of the universe, and as a consequence, the full reality of the universe seemed to grow progressively more alien. The ruling talismans of 20th century science, relativity, and quantum mechanics have become the ultimate in strangeness to the human mind. They were conceived by Albert Einstein, Max Planck, and other pioneers of theoretical physics during a search for quantifiable truths that would be known to extraterrestrials as well as to our species, and hence certifiably independent of the human mind. The physicists succeeded magnificently, but in so doing they revealed the limitations of intuition unaided by mathematics. An understanding of nature, they discovered, comes very hard. Theoretical physics and molecular biology are acquired tastes. The cost of scientific advance is the humbling recognition that reality was not constructed to be easily grasped by the human mind. This is the cardinal tenet of scientific understanding. Our species and its ways of thinking are a product of evolution, not the purpose of evolution. We now pass to the final archetype of the epic tableau, the keepers of the innermost room. The more radical Enlightenment writers, alert to the implications of scientific materialism, moved to reassess God himself. They invented a creator obedient to his own natural laws, the belief known as deism. They disputed the theism of Judeo-Christianity, whose divinity is both omnipotent and personally interested in human beings, and they rejected the non-material world of heaven and hell. At the same time, few dared to go the whole route and embrace atheism, which seemed to imply cosmic meaninglessness and risked outraging the pious. So, by and large, they took a middle position. God, the Creator, exists, they conceded, but he is allowed only the entities and processes manifest in his own handiwork. Deistic belief, by persisting in attenuated form to the present day, has given scientists a license to search for God. More precisely, it has prompted a small number to make a partial sketch of him, her, it, them, from their professional meditations. He is material in another plane, but not personal. He is perhaps the manager of alternative universes popping out of black holes, who adjusts physical laws and parameters in order to observe the outcome. Maybe we see a faint trace of him in the pattern of ripples in cosmic background radiation, dating back to the first moments of our own universe. Alternatively, we may be predestined to reach him billions of years in the future, at an omega point of evolution, total unity, total knowledge, toward which the human species and extraterrestrial life forms are converging. I must say that I have read many such schemes, and even though they are composed by scientists, I find them depressingly non-enlightenment, that the Creator lives outside this universe and will somehow be revealed at its end, is what the theologians have been telling us all along. Few scientists and philosophers, however, let alone religious thinkers, take the playful maunderings of scientific theology very seriously. A more coherent and interesting approach, possibly within the reach of theoretical physics, is to try to answer the following question. Is a universe of discrete material particles possible only with one specific set of natural laws and parameter values? In other words, does human imagination, which can conceive of other laws and values, thereby exceed possible existence? Any act of creation may be only a subset of the universes we can imagine. To this point, Einstein is reported to have remarked to his assistant, Ernst Strauss, in a moment of neo-deistic reflection, "What really interests me is whether God had any choice in the creation of the world." That line of reasoning can be extended rather mystically to formulate the anthropic principle, which notes that the laws of nature, in our universe at least, had to be set a certain precise way so as to allow the creation of beings able to ask about the laws of nature. Did someone decide to do it that way? The dispute between Enlightenment deism and theology can be summarized as follows. The traditional theism of Christianity is rooted in both reason and revelation, the two conceivable sources of knowledge. According to this view, reason and revelation cannot be in conflict because in areas of opposition, revelation is given the higher role, as the Inquisition reminded Galileo in Rome when they offered him a choice between orthodoxy and pain. In contrast, deism grants reason the edge and insists that theists justify revelation with the use of reason. Traditional theologians of the 18th century, faced with the Enlightenment challenge, refused to yield an inch of ground. Christian faith, they argued back, cannot submit itself to the debasing test of rationality. Deep truths exist that are beyond the grasp of the unaided human mind, and God will reveal them to our understanding when and by whatever means He chooses. Given the centrality of religion in everyday life, the stand of the theists against reason seemed, well, it seemed reasonable. Believers in the 18th century saw no difficulty in conducting their lives by both ratiocination and revelation. The theologians won the argument simply because there was no compelling reason to adopt a new metaphysics. For the first time, the Enlightenment visibly stumbled. The fatal flaw in deism is thus not rational at all, but emotional. Pure reason is unappealing because it is bloodless. Ceremonies stripped of sacred mystery lose their emotional force because celebrants need to defer to a higher power in order to consummate their instinct for tribal loyalty. In times of danger and tragedy especially, unreasoning ceremony is everything. There is no substitute for surrender to an infallible and benevolent being, the commitment called salvation, and no substitute for formal recognition of an immortal life force, the leap of faith called transcendence. It follows that most people would very much like science to prove the existence of God, but not to take the measure of His capacity. Deism and science also failed to colonize ethics. The sparkling Enlightenment promise of an objective basis for moral reasoning could not be met. If an immutable secular field of ethical premises exists, the human intellect during the Enlightenment seemed too weak and shifting to locate it. So theologians and philosophers stuck to their original positions, either by deferring to religious authority or by articulating subjectively perceived natural rights. There was no logical alternative open to them. The millennium-old rules sacralized by religion seemed to work, more or less, and in any case, there was no time to figure it all out. You can defer reflection on the celestial spheres indefinitely, but not on daily matters of life and death. There was and remains another, more purely rationalist objection to the Enlightenment program. Grant, for argument's sake, that the most extravagant claims of the Enlightenment supporters proved true, so that it became possible for scientists to look into the future and to see what course of action is best for humanity. Wouldn't that trap us in a cage of logic and revealed fate? The thrust of the Enlightenment, like the Greek humanism that prefigured it, was Promethean. The knowledge it generated was to liberate mankind by lifting it above the savage world. But the opposite might occur. If scientific inquiry diminishes the conception of divinity, while prescribing immutable natural laws, then humanity can lose what freedom it already possesses. Perhaps there is only one perfect social order, and scientists will find it, or worse, falsely claim to have found it. Religious authority, the Hadrian's Wall of civilization, will be breached, and the barbarians of totalitarian ideology will pour in. Such is the dark side of Enlightenment secular thought, unveiled in the French Revolution, and expressed more recently by theories of scientific socialism and racialist fascism. And there is another concern, that a science-driven society risks upsetting the natural order of the world set in place by God, or, if you prefer, by billions of years of evolution. Science, given too much authority, risks conversion into a self-destroying impiety. The godless creations of science and technology are, in fact, powerful and arresting images of modern culture. Frankenstein's monster and Hollywood's Terminator, the latter an all-metal and microchip-guided Frankenstein's monster, wreak destruction on their creators, including the naive geniuses in lab coats who arrogantly forecast a new age ruled by science. Storms rage, hostile mutants spread, life dies. Nations menace one another with world-destroying technology. Even Winston Churchill, whose country was saved by radar, worried after the atom bombing of Japan that the Stone Age might return on the gleaming wings of science. For those who for so long thus feared science as Faustian rather than Promethean, the Enlightenment program posed a grave threat to spiritual freedom, even to life itself. What is the answer to such a threat? Revolt! Return to natural man, reassert the primacy of individual imagination and confidence in immortality. Find an escape to a higher realm through art. Promote a romantic revolution. In 1807, William Wordsworth, in words typical of the movement then spreading over Europe, evoked the aura of a more primal and serene existence beyond reason's grasp. Our souls have sight of that immortal sea, which brought us hither, can in a moment travel thither, and see the children sport upon the shore, and hear the mighty waters rolling evermore. With Wordsworth's breathings for incommunicable powers, the eyes close, the mind soars, the inverse squared distance law of gravity falls away. The spirit enters another reality, beyond the reach of weight and measure. If the constraining universe of matter and energy cannot be denied, at least it can be ignored with splendid contempt. There is no question that Wordsworth and his fellow English Romantic poets of the first half of the 19th century conjured works of great beauty. They spoke truths in another tongue and guided the arts still further from the sciences. Romanticism also flowered in philosophy, where it placed a premium on rebellion, spontaneity, intense emotion, and heroic vision. Searching for aspirations available only to the heart, its practitioners dreamed of man as part of boundless nature. Rousseau, while often listed as an Enlightenment philosophe, was really instead the founder and most extreme visionary of the Romantic philosophical movement. For him, learning and social order are the enemies of humanity. In works from 1749, Discourse on the Sciences and the Arts, to 1762, Émile, he extolled the sleep of reason. His utopia is a minimalist state in which people abandon books and other accoutrements of intellect in order to cultivate enjoyment of the senses and good health. Humanity, Rousseau claimed, was originally a race of noble savages in a peaceful state of nature who were later corrupted by civilization and by scholarship. Religion, marriage, law, and government are deceptions created by the powerful for their own selfish ends. The price paid by the common man for this high-level chicanery is vice and unhappiness. Where Rousseau invented a stunningly inaccurate form of anthropology, the German Romantics, led by Goethe, Hegel, Herder, and Schelling, set out to reinsert metaphysics into science and philosophy. The product, Naturphilosophie, was a hybrid of sentiment, mysticism, and quasi-scientific hypothesis. Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, preeminent among its expositors, wanted most of all to be a great scientist. He placed that ambition above literature, where, in fact, he became an immortal contributor. His respect for science as an idea, an approach to tangible reality, was unreserved, and he understood its basic tenets. Analysis and synthesis, he liked to say, should be alternated as naturally as breathing in and breathing out. At the same time, he was critical of the mathematical abstractions of Newtonian science, thinking physics far too ambitious in its goal of explaining the universe. He was also often contemptuous of the technical tricks employed by experimental scientists. In fact, he tried to repeat Newton's optical experiments, but with poor results. Goethe can be easily forgiven. After all, he had a noble purpose, no less than the coupling of the soul of the humanities to the engine of science. He would have grieved had he foreseen history's verdict: great poet, poor scientist. He failed in his synthesis through lack of what is today called the scientist's instinct, not to mention the necessary technical skills. Calculus baffled him, and it is said he could not tell a lark from a sparrow, but he loved nature in a profoundly spiritual sense. "One must cultivate a close, deep feeling for her," he proclaimed. "She loves illusion. She shrouds man in mist, and she spurs him toward the light. Those who will not partake of her illusions, she punishes as a tyrant would punish. Those who accept her illusions, she presses to her heart. To love her is the only way to approach her." In the philosopher's Empyrean, I imagine Bacon has long since lectured Goethe on the idols of the mind. Newton will have lost patience immediately. Friedrich Schelling, leading philosopher of the German Romantics, attempted to bind the scientific Prometheus to immobility, not with poetry, but with reason. He proposed a cosmic unity of all things beyond the understanding of man. Facts by themselves can never be more than partial truths. Those we perceive are only fragments of the universal flux. "Nature is alive," Schelling concluded. "She is a creative spirit that unites knower and known, progressing through greater and greater understanding and feeling toward an eventual state of complete self-realization." In America, German philosophical romanticism was mirrored in New England transcendentalism, whose most celebrated proponents were Ralph Waldo Emerson and Henry David Thoreau. The transcendentalists were radical individualists who rejected the overwhelming commercialism that came to prevail in American society during the Jacksonian era. They envisioned a spiritual universe built entirely within their personal ethos. They nevertheless found science more congenial than did their European counterparts. Witness the many accurate natural history observations in Faith in a Seed and other writings by Thoreau. Their ranks even included one full-fledged scientist, Louis Agassiz, director of the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard University, founding member of the National Academy of Science, geologist, zoologist, and supremely gifted lecturer. This great man, in a metaphysical excursion paralleling that of Schelling, conceived the universe as a vision in the mind of God. The deities of science in his universe were essentially the same as those of theology. In 1859, at the height of his career, Agassiz was scandalized by the appearance of Darwin's Origin of Species, which advanced the theory of evolution by natural selection and saw the diversity of life as self-assembling. Surely, he argued before rapt audiences in cities along the Atlantic seaboard, God would not create the living world by random variation and survival of the fittest. Our view of life must not be allowed to descend from cosmic grandeur to the grubby details of ponds and woodlots. Even to think of the human condition in such a manner, he argued, is intolerable. Natural scientists, chastened by such robust objections to the Enlightenment agenda, mostly abandoned the examination of human mental life, yielding to philosophers and poets another century of free play. In fact, the concession turned out to be a healthy decision for the profession of science, because it steered researchers away from the pitfalls of metaphysics. Throughout the 19th century, knowledge in the physical and biological sciences grew at an exponential rate. At the same time, the social sciences, sociology, anthropology, economics, and political theory, newly risen like upstart duchies and earldoms, vied for territory in the space created between the hard sciences and the humanities. The great branches of learning emerged in their present form. Natural sciences, social sciences, and the humanities, out of the unified Enlightenment vision generated during the 17th and 18th centuries. The Enlightenment, defiantly secular in orientation, while indebted and attentive to theology, had brought the Western mind to the threshold of a new freedom. It waved aside everything, every form of religious and civil authority, every imaginable fear, to give precedence to the ethic of free inquiry. It pictured a universe in which humanity plays the role of perpetual adventurer. For two centuries, God seemed to speak in a new voice to humankind. That voice had been foreshadowed in 1486 by Giovanni Pico della Mirandola, Renaissance forerunner of the Enlightenment thinkers, in this benediction: "We have made thee neither of heaven nor of earth, neither mortal nor immortal, so that with freedom of choice and with honor, as though the maker and molder of thyself, thou mayest fashion thyself in whatever shape thou shalt prefer." By the early 1800s, however, the splendid image was fading, reason fractured, intellectuals lost faith in the leadership of science, and the prospect of the unity of knowledge sharply declined. It is true that the spirit of the Enlightenment lived on in political idealism and the hopes of individual thinkers. In the ensuing decades, new schools sprang up like shoots from the base of a shattered tree: the utilitarian ethics of Bentham and Mill, the historical materialism of Marx and Engels, the pragmatism of Charles Peirce, William James, and John Dewey. But the core agenda seemed irretrievably abandoned. The grand conception that had riveted thinkers during the previous two centuries lost most of its credibility. Science traveled its own way. It continued to double every 15 years in practitioners, discoveries, and technical journals, as it had since the early 1700s, finally beginning to level off only around 1970. Its continuously escalating success began to give credence again to the idea of an ordered, intelligible universe. This essential Enlightenment premise grew stronger in the disciplines of mathematics, physics, and biology, where it had first been conceived by Bacon and Descartes. Yet the enormous success of reductionism, its key method, worked perversely against any recovery of the Enlightenment program as a whole. Precisely because scientific information was growing at a geometric pace, most individual researchers were not concerned with unification, and even less with philosophy. They thought, what works, works, and so what need is there to reflect more deeply on the matter? They were even slower to address the taboo-laden physical basis of mind, a concept hailed in the late 1700s as the gateway from biology to the social sciences. There was another, humbler reason for the lack of interest in the big picture. Scientists simply didn't have the requisite intellectual energy. The vast majority of scientists have never been more than journeymen prospectors. That is even more the case today. They are professionally focused. Their education does not orient them to the wide contours of the world. They acquire the training they need to travel to the frontier and make discoveries of their own and as fast as possible, because life at the growing edge is expensive and chancy. The most productive scientists, installed in million-dollar laboratories, have no time to think about the big picture and see little profit in it. The rosette of the United States National Academy of Sciences, which the 2,000 elected members wear on their lapels as a mark of achievement, contains a center of scientific gold surrounded by the purple of natural philosophy. The eyes of most leading scientists, alas, are fixed on the gold. It is therefore not surprising to find physicists who do not know what a gene is, and biologists who guess that string theory has something to do with violins. Grants and honors are given in science for discoveries, not for scholarship and wisdom. And so has it ever been. Francis Bacon, using the political skills that lofted him to the Lord Chancellorship, personally importuned the English monarchs for funds to carry forth his great scheme of unifying knowledge. He never got a penny. At the height of his fame, Descartes was ceremoniously awarded a stipend by the French royal court, but the account remained unfunded, helping to drive him to the more generous Swedish court in the land of bears between rock and ice, where he soon died of pneumonia. The same professional atomization afflicts the social sciences and humanities. The faculties of higher education around the world are a congeries of experts. To be an original scholar is to be a highly specialized world authority in a polyglot Calcutta of similarly focused world authorities. In 1797, when Jefferson took the president's chair at the American Philosophical Society, all American scientists of professional caliber and their colleagues in the humanities could be seated comfortably in the lecture room of Philosophical Hall. Most could discourse reasonably well on the entire world of learning, which was still small enough to be seen whole. Their successors today, including 450,000 holders of the doctorate in science and engineering alone, would overcrowd Philadelphia. Professional scholars in general have little choice but to dice up research expertise and research agendas among themselves. To be a successful scholar means spending a career on membrane biophysics, the Romantic poets, early American history, or some other such constricted area of formal study. Fragmentation of expertise was further mirrored in the 20th century by modernism in the arts, including architecture. The work of the masters, Braque, Picasso, Stravinsky, Eliot, Joyce, Martha Graham, Gropius, Frank Lloyd Wright, and their peers was so novel and discursive as to thwart generic classification, except perhaps for this. The modernists tried to achieve the new and provocative at any cost. They identified the constraining bonds of tradition and self-consciously broke them. Many rejected realism in expression in order to explore the unconscious. Freud, as much a literary stylist as a scientist, inspired them and can be justifiably included in their ranks. Psychoanalysis was a force that shifted the attention of modernist intellectuals and artists from the social and political to the private and psychological, subjecting every topic within their domain to the ruthless centrifuge of change, in Karl Shorsky's phrase. They meant to proudly assert the independence of 20th century high culture from the past. They were not nihilists. Rather, they sought to create a new level of order and meaning. They were complete experimentalists who wished to participate in a century of radical technological and political change and to fashion part of it entirely on their own terms. Thus, the free flight bequeathed by the Enlightenment, which disengaged the humanities during the Romantic era, had, by the middle of the 20th century, all but erased hope for the unification of knowledge with the aid of science. The two cultures, described by C.P. Snow in his 1959 Reed lecture, the literary and the scientific, were no longer on speaking terms. All movements tend to extremes, which is approximately where we are today. The exuberant self-realization that ran from Romanticism to Modernism has given rise now to philosophical postmodernism, often called post-structuralism, especially in its more political and sociological expressions. Postmodernism is the ultimate polar antithesis of the Enlightenment. The difference between the two extremes can be expressed roughly as follows. Enlightenment thinkers believe we can know everything, and radical postmodernists believe we can know nothing. The philosophical postmodernists, a rebel crew milling beneath the black flag of anarchy, challenge the very foundations of science and traditional philosophy. Reality, they propose, is a state constructed by the mind, not perceived by it. In the most extravagant version of this constructivism, there is no real reality, no objective truths external to mental activity, only prevailing versions disseminated by ruling social groups. Nor can ethics be firmly grounded, given that each society creates its own codes for the benefit of the same oppressive forces. If these premises are correct, it follows that one culture is as good as any other in the expression of truth and morality, each in its own special way. Political multiculturalism is justified. Each ethnic group and sexual preference in the community has equal validity, and more than mere tolerance, it deserves communal support and mandated representation in educational agendas, not because it has general importance to the society, but because it exists. That is, again, if the premises are correct. And they must be correct, say their promoters, because to suggest otherwise is bigotry, which is a cardinal sin. Cardinal, that is, if we agree to waive in this one instance the postmodernist prohibition against universal truth, and all agree to agree for the common good. Thus, Rousseau redivivus. Postmodernism is expressed more explicitly still in deconstruction, a technique of literary criticism. Each author's meaning is unique to himself, goes the underlying premise. nothing of his true intention or anything else connected to objective reality can be reliably assigned to it. His text is, therefore, open to fresh analysis and commentary issuing from the equally solipsistic world in the head of the reviewer. But then the reviewer is, in turn, subject to deconstruction, as well as the reviewer of the reviewer, and so on, in infinite regress. That is what Jacques Derrida, the creator of deconstruction, meant when he stated the formula, "Il n'y a pas d'hors texte." There is nothing outside the text. At least that is what I think he meant, after reading him, his defenders, and his critics with some care. If the radical postmodernist premise is correct, we can never be sure that is what he meant. Conversely, if that is what he meant, it is not certain we are obliged to consider his arguments further. This puzzle, which I am inclined to set aside as the Derrida paradox, is similar to the Cretan paradox. A Cretan says, "All Cretans are liars." It awaits solution, though one need not feel any great sense of urgency in the matter. Nor is it certain, from Derrida's ornately obscurantist prose, that he himself knows what he means. Some observers think his writing is meant as a jeu d'esprit, a kind of joke. His new science of grammatology is the opposite of science, rendered in fragments with the incoherence of a dream, at once banal and fantastical. It is innocent of the science of mind and language developed elsewhere in the civilized world, rather like the pronouncements of a faith healer unaware of the location of the pancreas. He seems, in the end, to be conscious of this omission, but contents himself with the stance of Rousseau, self-professed enemy of books and writing, whose work Émile, he quotes, "The dreams of a bad night are given to us as philosophy." You will say, I too am a dreamer. I admit it, but I do what others fail to do. I give my dreams as dreams, and leave the reader to discover whether there is anything in them which may prove useful to those who are awake. Scientists, awake and held responsible for what they say while awake, have not found postmodernism useful. The postmodernist posture toward science, in return, is one of subversion. There appears to be a provisional acceptance of gravity, the periodic table, astrophysics, and similar stanchions of the external world, but in general, the scientific culture is viewed as just another way of knowing, and moreover, contrived mostly by European and American white males. It is tempting to relegate postmodernism to history's curiosity cabinet, alongside theosophy and transcendental idealism, but it has seeped by now into the mainstream of the social sciences and humanities. It is viewed there as a technique of meta-theory, theory about theories, by which scholars analyze not so much the subject matter of the scientific discipline as the cultural and psychological reasons particular scientists think the way they do. The analyst places emphasis on root metaphors, those ruling images in the thinker's mind by which he designs theory and experiments. Here, for example, is Kenneth Gergen explaining how modern psychology is dominated by the metaphor of human beings as machines. Regardless of the character of the person's behavior, the mechanist theorist is virtually obliged to segment him from the environment, to view the environment in terms of stimulus or input elements, to view the person as reactive to and dependent on these input elements, to view the domain of the mental as structured, constituted of interacting elements, to segment behavior into units that can be coordinated to the stimulus inputs, and so on. Put briefly, and to face the issue squarely, psychology is at risk of becoming a natural science. As a possible remedy for those who wish to keep it otherwise, and there are many scholars who do, Gergen cites other, perhaps less pernicious, root metaphors of mental life that might be considered, such as the marketplace, dramaturgy, and rule-following. Psychology, if not allowed to be contaminated with too much biology, can accommodate endless numbers of theoreticians.